This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Hey there, welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. I'm Jill, and I'm not your grandma. Today, I'm going to take a look at the mothers of Israel, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah, and Rachel, and the birth speeches of Leah and Rachel found in Genesis 29:31 through 30:24 and 35:16 through 21. These passages narrate the conceptions, pregnancies, and births of 12 of Jacob's sons and one named daughter, although it's likely he had more daughters. They also include dialogue between Jacob and Rachel, as well as Rachel and Leah, providing insight into potential family dynamics. The majority of this research was done while I was a graduate student at Oklahoma City University in a class I took on women in the Hebrew Bible with Dr. Lisa Wolf. You might remember her from our Ecclesiastes episode. As always, if you have further questions or would like some clarification, feel free to email me at notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com and I will get back with you as soon as I can. So let's dive in. The matriarchs hold a special place in the Hebrew canon and society. They are so much more than just Jacob's wives or simply the mothers of Jacob's sons. Specifically, Leah and Rachel's naming speeches reveal many things about their relationship with one another, with their shared husband Jacob, and with their God. Through these speeches, the reader learns not only that 12 sons and one daughter are born, but also to whom they are born and the reason behind why they are named what they are. We also get a glimpse into the private lives of Rachel and Jacob, and an interesting, though not original, solution to Rachel's struggle with infertility. Besides Leah and Rachel, who name their children and the children of their slave women Bilhah and Zilpah as well, only two other women in Genesis are given a voice in the naming of their children. Eve names Cain in 4:1 by saying, "I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord." Tamar in Genesis 38:29 says, "What a breach you have made for yourself in naming Perez." With all the birth accounts in the book of Genesis, specific accounts such as Cain, Abel, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, Esau, and these general genealogies, it is quite significant that Leah and Rachel not only name all 12 of the male children, but also, with the exception of Benjamin, are given the stage to say why they named them. It's also noteworthy that while Dinah is named and is therefore more privileged than most women in the Bible, there is no speech accompanying her name to explain its meaning. Before getting into the specific text under consideration, let's first get a handle on what's going on in the story leading up to our passage. Jacob has left his home with his father Isaac's charge to find a wife among his mother Rebekah's kin, specifically her brother's daughters. This is an example of the endogamous marriage that is typical of the ancestral stories of Israel. Abram and Sarai were half-siblings sharing a father, while Isaac and Rebekah were cousins once removed, since Rebekah was Abram's great-niece. Isaac is now encouraging Jacob to find a wife from his pool of first cousins. Isaac has wished the blessing of God to be upon Jacob so that he may be fruitful and multiply. On his way to Laban's, Jacob has a dream in which God tells him that his descendants will be as the dust of the earth. From early in the narrative, it is insinuated that God alone is in control of Jacob's progeny, and only God knows how numerous that progeny will be. We are first introduced to Rachel at the well where her father Laban watered his flock. Rachel is a shepherd who has brought her father's flocks to the well. Will Gaffney highlights the importance of Rachel's role as shepherd since, quote, "shepherding is a powerful and dominant metaphor for leading the people of Israel as a civil," that is monarch, "and religious," that is prophet, "leader, and for God's own care of God's people," end quote. Gaffney reminds us that the imagery is sustained into the New Testament with descriptions of Jesus and later into our modern congregations as a metaphor for pastoral leadership. So Jacob meets Rachel at the well, and this leads to the dramatic scene in which Jacob rolls the large stone away from the well by himself, kisses Rachel, and weeps. Later, Jacob meets Laban and agrees to work for him for 7 years so that Rachel, the younger of Laban's two daughters, might be his wife. We are briefly introduced to Leah in 29:17 and told that she is older than Rachel and that she had, quote, weak eyes. Perhaps it means there was something wrong with her eyes, or perhaps it means there was something peculiar about how she sees things. This is contrasted by the description of Rachel, who is described as being beautiful of form and face. Rachel is the focus of Jacob's affection, and Leah proves to be a foil to his love story. After 7 years, Jacob has earned the right to marry Laban's daughter. He anticipates Rachel, but on the wedding night, Laban substitutes Leah. Jacob awakens the next morning to quite the wedding gift. In 29:25, it says, "So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah." And just as a side note, how did he not realize who she was before the marriage was consummated? Men, just do better. Back to the story. Angry, Jacob confronts Laban. Laban tells him it is customary to marry the older before the younger, so Jacob agrees to work 7 more years for Rachel. 29:30 rounds out this portion of the narrative by informing the audience that Jacob loved Rachel more than he loved Leah, which implies that he did love Leah, he just loved Rachel more. Despite his greater love towards Rachel, it is Leah who is carrying Jacob's first child. Before learning of Leah's conception, the reader is told that God saw that Leah was unloved. Some translations, such as the King James Version, translate the word as hated, and opened her womb while Rachel was barren. Joan Ross Burstall states it this way, quote, "The author juxtaposes the action and attitude of Jacob toward Rachel with those of God toward Leah," end quote. Before both sections of Leah's birth speeches, we are told that God is responsible for her fertility. God, quote, "opened her womb" at 29:31 and gave heed to her at 30:17. Before the birth of Joseph, after Jacob has 10 sons and 1 daughter, God finally remembered Rachel and opened her womb at 30:22. The society in which Leah and Rachel lived is a far cry from the world we inhabit. Strategically planning pregnancies would have required an understanding of the female reproductive system beyond the knowledge of ancient folk, and quite frankly, beyond the interest of ancient men. Medical procedures like in vitro and fertility drugs were obviously unavailable, and standardized prenatal care was just not an option. The goal in the agrarian society was to have as many children as possible and pray that they were male. Children were needed in the daily operations of performing the household duties. Athalia Brenner succinctly writes, quote, "In her kind of society, an individual has no power unless he or she is protected by the family. Therefore, family continuity is a supreme value that ought to override matters of personal happiness and fulfillment," end quote. The importance of male offspring is rooted in the patriarchal societal structure of ancient Israel. Lineage was traced through the male, and with no sons, a man's lineage ended. Allow me to quote Sharon Pace Jensen at length. Quote, "Be fruitful and multiply," 1:28, is the first command of God in the book of Genesis, and fertility is always associated with blessing throughout the Hebrew Bible. In a society where population growth was desirable and equated with political strength, and where infant mortality was high, neither men nor women believed that not wanting children was acceptable. The stories of the matriarchs reveal the patriarchal goal of having sons to add to a man's prestige and material well-being. However, they also present the prominent theological perspective that the God who calls Abraham out of Ur keeps the promise of descendants and is a powerful God of fertility. End quote. So let's get back to Leah. "Now the Lord saw that Leah was hated." Gaffney reminds us that the word used here doesn't simply mean unloved or loved less, but hated. However, and I quote, "the text does not say that she is hated by Jacob, leaving open the possibility that she is hated by her husband, sister, and or father, and perhaps others," end quote. The uses of this same word, sane, in the Joseph stories might shed some light on this if one assumes that it is either Jacob or Rachel who hates Leah. In the Joseph narrative, the brothers hate Joseph. He is arrogant and acting as if he were the oldest of the sons. They first hate him in 37:4 when they see that Jacob loves him more. Jacob is like really bad at playing favorites. They hate him more when Joseph tells the brothers his dream in 37:5, and they hate him even more when they realize in 37:8 that the dream means Joseph will have dominion over them specifically. Within this context, at least, this word seems to mean more than an emotional response, though it's not completely separate from it. Joseph is hated because he is a younger son acting as if he is the eldest. He's operating in a position that, at least in his brother's minds, does not belong to him. Taking this into consideration, the problem in the Leah-Jacob union is not Leah. It is that Leah is not Rachel. Leah is the first wife, the chief wife. She is also the wife that is producing offspring. Jacob worked 14 years for Rachel. Rachel is the woman he wanted from the moment they met, and Jacob was tricked into marrying Leah. There is cause for either Jacob or Rachel, if not both, to hate Leah, since she holds a position that, by their estimation, ought to belong to Rachel. So whatever this hatred meant sexually for Leah and Jacob is really unclear. What the text does reveal about their marital relationship is twofold. First, she bore him 6 sons and 1 daughter, presumably within the second set of 7 years he was working for Laban to earn Rachel, although Gaffney suggests that it could be over a longer period of time if one assumes that Leah does not get pregnant again until after the previous child is weaned. Either way, this indicates the fertility of Leah. And secondly, Leah did not control Jacob's sexual activity as much as Rachel did, and this is demonstrated in 30:15 when Rachel gives Leah permission to have sex with Jacob. In Leviticus 22, the days of ritual uncleanness after the birth of a child are laid out for women based on the sex of a child. So it's unlikely that Jacob and the women would have practiced such strict guidelines, as this story is set in a time prior to the giving of the law. Regardless of the amount of time spent after the birth of one child and the conception of the next, it is evident that Leah spent very little of her first years of marriage without being pregnant, if one assumes that these pregnancies all occurred during the second set of 7 years that Jacob worked for Laban. If that is the case, she had 7 children in 7 years. So just for fun, if one assumes that A, all of these pregnancies occurred in the second set of 7 years that Jacob worked for Laban to earn Rachel, and B, that all 7 of Leah's pregnancies were full term, that is 40 weeks, then there were only 595 days of those 7 years that she was not pregnant. When you further consider that her slave woman Zilpah gives birth to 2 more children for her, then that means there are only 35 days over that 7 years that Leah is not pregnant or concerned with a pregnancy. This level of fertility borders on the absurd, and it is a clear indication that the author of the text is more concerned with continuing the theme of God's divine intervention in the lives of the ancestral families than it is with relaying facts in the way that we moderns would prefer. It's possible that Leah's perpetual pregnancies, rather than Rachel's control, may be the cause of minimal sexual activity between the couple. Genesis 30, verse 9 says that Leah saw that she stopped bearing, but the text gives no indication that it is due to a sexual abstinence with Jacob. What the text does indicate is that, regardless of how many children Leah were to bear for Jacob, he would never satisfy Leah's desire for him. This becomes evident in the speeches that accompany the naming of her children. And just as a side note, based on the numbers I discussed before, how long did Leah have to go before she could see that she stopped bearing? Was it like, well, it's been 2 months since I delivered my last kid, so I should be pregnant by now. I guess God closed up shop on my womb. Better give my slave over to a forced sexual union with my husband because I gotta have me a quiverful. Anyway, I really don't know what Leah was thinking and how long she possibly could have gone without getting pregnant. So, anyway. Now, you may be asking, if he didn't like Leah, why didn't he just divorce her? And the answer is there could be several reasons why Jacob didn't divorce Leah. Perhaps he was afraid of what Laban might do if he did. Perhaps he felt an obligation toward his kinswoman that would not allow him to forsake her completely. Or perhaps he realized that she was the wife that would provide the children to carry on his lineage. The text doesn't indicate any reason why Jacob didn't divorce Leah. There was no Torah to define his actions, but there must have been something that kept Jacob bound to Leah. But whatever that something is, the author either takes it for granted or finds it to be of little import for the purpose of this narrative. So as I've already stated, Leah is the first to become pregnant, and the narrative sets Leah's fertility and rejection by Jacob in contrast with Rachel's barrenness and favor. Leah bears 4 children consecutively in 29, 31 through 35. The first 3 naming speeches are all linked to her relationship with Jacob, and 3 of the 4 are connected to her belief in God. Reuben is her firstborn. His name literally means, see, a son. Her speech here is twofold. She first acknowledges the favor that God has shown her. God has indeed seen her affliction and allowed her to bring forth a son. She concludes that since she has given Jacob his firstborn son, quote, surely now my husband will love me, end quote, in 29:32. The narrator quickly moves on to the conception and birth of Leah's next son, which, though not explicitly stating it, assumes the role of Jacob as the impregnator. Leah's naming of her and Jacob's second son indicates that the birth of Reuben did not solve her problem as she thought it would. Ross Burstall notes, the name Simeon is associated with the term Sime, literally he who hears, and I am not going to lie, I don't think I pronounced that Hebrew word correctly. Anyway, Leah believes that God has heard that she is unloved and has therefore given her Simeon also. She says, behold, the Lord has heard that I am hated. He has given me this son also. She does not mention Jacob in this speech, but he may be understood as the one who hates her. Always remember, the text does not clarify that, so we're filling in gaps. Perhaps she views Simeon as a means of making up for the fact that she is hated, or as a means, as she had hoped with Reuben, of gaining Jacob's love. The text is ambiguous at best. Regardless of the way Leah interpreted the birth of Simeon, it was not enough to satisfy her longing for her husband, as is evident with the birth of her third child. For the first time, Leah recognizes Jacob as father, saying, now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him 3 sons, at 29:34. She does not mention God in this speech, and it is the only one of her naming speeches for her biological children that she does not. Levi's name is connected with the word Yahweh, which literally means he will be joined. His name is almost a prayer, perhaps a talisman, that Jacob will love her. And Leah is still not satisfied with her lot. She has 3 children, and boys at that, giving her a place in her society, but she doesn't have her husband's love. With the birth of her 4th child, Leah's attitude seems to shift. Her first 3 sons encouraged her hope that Jacob would love her, but there is no mention of her relationship with Jacob in this speech. Leah simply says, this time I will praise the Lord. Judah's name has an association with the term Odeh, literally I will praise. There is no clear reason why she changes with this birth of Judah. Perhaps she recognized that despite being rejected by her husband, she was favored by God, or she may have only momentarily felt as though Jacob's attitude toward her had changed, or she may have been grateful simply for having another son. Whatever her reasoning, Leah is resolved, if not content, to praise God. Rachel, however, is another story altogether. Genesis 30, verse 1 says, now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. After watching her sister give Jacob son after son after son after son, Rachel finally confronts Jacob, demanding children lest she die. And it is darkly ironic that she views her barrenness as deadly when she ultimately dies giving birth to Benjamin in 35:16-18, a harrowing reminder of the fragility of life and the dangers of childbirth in the ancient world, and even today. Jacob becomes angry with Rachel. Will Gaffney notes that, quote, the expression denotes a snorting bull. He asks her quite sharply, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? Jacob thus denies any responsibility for the situation, and he shifts the focus to God. In Rachel's day and age, it would have been understood as being the woman's fault if no children were born into a marriage, and since Jacob already had impregnated Leah 4 times by this point, there's no textual evidence to suggest that Jacob is sterile. Still, it is quite significant that he does not assume Rachel to be at fault for her barrenness, believing instead that the power to produce children belongs solely to God. Rachel, however, cannot be content with Jacob's understanding of God as in control of Rachel's fertility. As with Sarah in 16:2, Rachel suggests using Bilhah, her slave woman, or womb slave, as Will Gaffney aptly describes her, as a surrogate mother. Gaffney reminds us, quote, "Bilhah is first Laban's slave and then Rachel's. The only service she performs in the text is reproductive," end quote. In 30 verse 3, Rachel tells Jacob, "Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children." And like Abraham, Jacob agrees. It's really uncertain what bear on my knees means. Some believe it is a figurative expression, meaning I will raise her children, suggesting some sort of ancient ritual indicating the adoption of the child. Some view this as Rachel's fertility wish, and I find this more compelling. Jeffrey Tigay, T-I-G-A-Y, hoping I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, describes birth on the knees as more likely reflecting, quote, "the position taken in antiquity by a woman during childbirth, straddling the knees of an attendant, another woman, or at times her own husband, upon whose knees the emerging child was received. Perhaps Rachel attended Bilhah herself in order to cure, in a sympathetic, magical way, her own infertility," end quote. So what's clear here is that Rachel is attempting to solve her personal and marital problem. The readers are first introduced to Bilhah and Zilpah in 29:24 and 29. Laban gives Bilhah to Rachel as her slave and Zilpah to Leah. They are not mentioned again until they are given to Jacob as wives in 30 verse 4 and 9. Each time we meet the women, they are passive characters with no voice of their own, being gifted and regifted at will. Most translations soften the language to refer to these women as maidservants, but I wholeheartedly agree with Will Gaffney that the language is misleading at best. She writes, quote, "I choose the translation slave rather than servant to emphasize that these persons were bought and sold, used for sex, impregnated, and completely subjugated to the power of those called their mistresses and masters. Servitude suggests employment, which is not the case for slaves in the biblical corpus," end quote. Bilhah and Zilpah are mothers of two sons each. Bilhah is given to Jacob by Rachel after Rachel realizes that she cannot conceive. Zilpah is given by Leah after she realizes that she has stopped bearing children. Though Bilhah and Zilpah are commonly understood to be concubines of Jacob, the text calls them wives. The word is isha and is always translated as wife. The word for concubine is pilagesh, and it does not appear in this section of the text. Bilhah and Zilpah should be understood as having the same rights as Leah and Rachel, since the same word describes all four women in their relationship to Jacob. If it is Jacob's emotional availability to these women that determines whether they were concubines or wives, then Leah is as much a concubine for Jacob as either of these women, since Jacob's preference lies solely with Rachel. Unlike Leah's pregnancies, the active participation of God is absent. There is no divine intervention on Bilhah or Zilpah's behalf. Bilhah, by Rachel's orchestration, conceives first. The text is clear that all four of Bilhah and Zilpah's children are born to Jacob, not to Rachel, not to Leah. Still, Leah and Rachel name these four sons also. Bilhah's first son is Dan. Rachel appears to claim him as her own in her speech, accrediting God with vindicating her by saying, "God has judged me and has also heard my voice and given me a son." Bilhah's second son is Naphtali. It is in this naming speech that Rachel claims victory over Leah, saying, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." It seems likely that the sisters were wrestling for Jacob's favor, with childbearing being the mechanism for obtaining that favor. Yet the text does not make that clear. The text also does not reveal if Leah is aware of Rachel's feelings of animosity at this point. Nor does it explain how Rachel won in this fight with her sister. If it is through children, then Leah is still in the lead, so to speak, and her children are biologically her own. The speech concerning the birth of Naphtali raises many questions that don't have answers apparent in the text. Rachel's first naming speeches, whatever new questions they may raise, indicate her status with God and her sister is in proper order. God has judged her and granted her a son. Leah is defeated. Zilpah is the next to become pregnant. There is no reason for Leah to give Zilpah as a wife to Jacob other than that she has seen she has stopped bearing. It's unclear whether she wishes Zilpah to have children for Jacob or for herself. She does, however, name Zilpah's children. The first she names Gad, meaning fortune, exclaiming how fortunate. When Asher, meaning happy, is born, Leah says that she is happy and that women will call her happy. In contrast to Rachel, Leah's speeches are free from jealousy and strife, yet both women's speeches acknowledge a sense of contentment and satisfaction, however short-lived it may be. The next scene, 30 verses 14 and 15, is the first to have a dialogue between Leah and Rachel. It says, "In the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother, Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, 'Please give me some of your son's mandrakes.' But she said to her, 'Is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you also take away my son's mandrakes?' And Rachel replied, 'Then he may lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes.'" In many ancient cultures, mandrakes were considered an aphrodisiac. This would explain Rachel's desire for these love apples, as they were sometimes called. After Reuben, Leah's eldest, came in from the field with the mandrakes, he delivers them to his mother. This brief scene sets up the reader for the first dialogue between Rachel and Leah, and the first time Leah even acknowledges Rachel in the text. So Rachel requested that Leah give her some of Reuben's mandrakes. Rachel approached Leah in a polite fashion. She even says, "Please." Leah, however, was not so pleasant. She sharply replied, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" As Jensen notes, quote, "The statement indicates that she was the second but more beloved wife. Rachel has usurped Leah's position of privilege as first wife and firstborn. It also indicates that at some point in the marriage, Rachel has obtained sexual monopoly of Jacob," end quote. Rachel responded by using Jacob as a bargaining tool. She offers to exchange one night with Jacob for Reuben's mandrakes, and Leah agreed. Rachel's response indicates three things. First, Rachel had more control over Jacob's sexual activity than Leah, and perhaps even Jacob. Second, Leah did not have the same type of access to her husband that Rachel did. And third, Rachel is in control of the entire situation. She knew what to offer in order to get what she wanted. Rachel wanted children, and the mandrakes could be a means to that end. Leah wanted Jacob, and the giving up of the mandrakes was the means to that end. The interesting twist in the story comes in 30:16. When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in to me tonight, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." Jacob is passive and objectified, in the same way that the sisters were objectified by Laban back in 29 verses 21 through 25 on the wedding night, so Jacob is powerless. He is completely silent and simply does as he is told. The next verse explains just how productive that one night was. She conceived and she bore Jacob a fifth son. The fifth child, Issachar, is born. The speech, "God has given me my hire because I gave my maid to my husband," is a direct response to Leah's giving of Zilpah to Jacob and the hiring of Jacob for the night. Leah seems to be gloating. She acknowledges the favor of God in her pregnancy because she gave her maid to Jacob, but Rachel also gave her maid to Jacob and is yet without children. Leah's one night with Jacob clearly does not stop there. After the birth of Issachar, we are told that Leah conceived again. The text says she bears Jacob a sixth son. "God has endowed me with a good gift," she says. "Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." It is interesting that after giving Zilpah to Jacob as a wife and even naming her children for her in a way that suggests adoption, her naming speech here mentions only her six sons. The naming of Zebulun is also reminiscent of the namings of Reuben and Levi. In all three, she hopes that the children will cause her husband to cling to her in a way that he hasn't yet. After all three, the reader is left assuming that Jacob has not changed. And as a sort of encore performance, Leah delivers a baby girl. Dinah has no naming speech. Her birth announcement is sort of an afterthought. And from this point on in Genesis, Leah virtually disappears, with her death being reported in 49:31. She is absent from the narrative recounting the rape of her daughter Dinah and Rachel's death scene, though Jacob requests to be buried with Leah, not Rachel, in 49:29-33. Gaffney summarizes the character of Leah in this way. Allow me to quote again at length here. "Leah, the loveless matriarch, is a heartbreaking character. There is no happy ending for Leah. She is not fulfilled as a person or as a woman in motherhood. She is not the last woman to go to her grave longing for the love of a man who does not love her but is willing to sleep with her. Pious women, readers, hearers, may not choose to be Leah, but I suspect Leah's story canonized her lovelessness as well as her fruitfulness, because it rang true to human experience. Leah offers a cautionary tale to women looking for fulfillment in someone else's love. You cannot make someone love you. End quote. The naming speeches in this passage come to a triumphant end with the birth of Joseph. Then God remembered Rachel, and God heeded her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And she named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord add to me another son. The barren Rachel is finally remembered by God and given a child. As with Leah, God is an active participant. It is God who opens Rachel's womb. It is not the work of the mandrakes, nor is it a reward for giving Jacob Bilhah, as Leah has assumed in the naming of Issachar. Rachel's response is to say that God has taken away her reproach. She may have felt vindicated by God with the birth of Bilhah's son Dan, but it is only in the birth of Joseph, which means addition, that removes her reproach. She ends by asking the Lord for another son. She now recognizes that the solution to her infertility lies in the realm of the divine. God is a God that remembers the afflicted and works for their benefit. The final naming comes in Genesis 35:16-21, which I'm going to read in whole for you here. They journeyed from Bethel, and when they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel was in childbirth, and she had hard labor. When she was in her hard labor, the midwife said to her, do not be afraid, for now you will have another son. As her soul was departing, for she died, she named him Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar at her grave. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. In this passage, Rachel names her son, but Jacob inexplicably renames him. Gaffney puts it this way, quote, the name Rachel chooses for her second son, Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow, is not honored by Jacob. He renames the boy Benjamin, Benjamin, right-hand son, end quote. There is no accompanying birth speech, except perhaps that of her midwife reassuring her that she is having a boy. It is a tragic end to a very complicated story. Again, Gaffney summarizing Rachel's story. Lament and blessing characterize the portrayal of Rachel in the scriptures. A pawn of her father, in conflict with her sister, loved by a man she does not say she loves, ashamed of her infertility, and finally, a mother granted fertility by God, dead before seeing her children grown and married, her deathbed wishes disregarded. End quote. Leah and Rachel are sisters who are locked in competition with one another. The thing the women don't seem to realize is that they are fighting for different things. Leah is seeking the favor of Jacob. She desires for him to love her, and this desire comes through in the way she names her children. Her first and last children are both announced with the hopes that Jacob will become attached to her, will love her, will favor her. Any jealousy she may feel towards Rachel has nothing to do with their social status, but with their status in the home. Rachel, on the other hand, desires children. She desires a status in society comparable to the status she holds with Jacob. She is favored, and even her barrenness cannot persuade Jacob to reject her. A child, specifically a son, is the one thing she wants and the one thing she cannot have. Despite all her attempts to manipulate the situation and become a mother, she remains barren while Leah mothers 7 children, until finally God opens her womb, allowing her to conceive. And yet it is that very gift of children that will kill her. The giving of life takes her life. The conflict inherent in the nature of the Leah-Jacob-Rachel love triangle seems almost difficult to overcome. However, don't give up hope. Later, we see Leah and Rachel working together for the sake of Jacob in Genesis 31:1-16. Jacob describes to Leah and Rachel the work he has done for Laban, how the Lord has given all of Laban's flocks over to Jacob, and how Laban has looked less favorably upon Jacob because of this. He then tells him that God has told him to return to his birthland. Leah and Rachel agree that they too are perceived as foreigners in their father's home and have lost their inheritance. It is better for them to remain with Jacob and do as the Lord has commanded him. In this scene, there is no rivalry, no infighting. For their own sakes, for the sake of their children, they join Jacob to flee from Laban. Perhaps, despite all odds, there's hope that peace can happen in the midst of conflict. But that's a discussion for another day. I hope you enjoyed today's dive into the story of Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah, and Rachel's relationships with one another, with Jacob, with their children. Again, send any questions or comments to notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com. I'll do my best to get back to you as soon as possible. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and a positive review. Reviews specifically are how podcasts gain notoriety and visibility. If your comment has to do with some technical aspect of the show, for instance, sound quality or something like that, please shoot me an email. I don't check the reviews too often for my own mental health, but some of those types of issues can be resolved quickly on my end. Okay, grandmas, stay safe out there. Fight the good fight. Love your neighbor. Wear your mask. Catch you next time. Amen and Selah.